Welcome back to another episode of The Political Life. Today, we have one of our stars, a prior guest, Josh Gray. Josh has a new job. We first had Josh on the show February 2021, one of our more popular shows and popular guests. I can't believe it's been a year and a half or something. Josh has a new job, which was the excuse to have him back on, but it was really just an excuse. Josh was at the National Coalition on Black Civic Participation, and now he is at Ogilvy. And so we're going to hear all about that. Josh, welcome back.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I was thinking to myself, when was the last time, we actually had this conversation? And I didn't realize it's a year. So yes, a year has flown by, as one would say, but really exciting. Thanks, Jim, for inviting me on the show again to kind of give, I guess, an update.
Yes, an update on your
high expectations, I guess.
Yes. What? All right. So, how? Tell us about your work at Ogilvy.
Yeah, it was interesting. I have been a part of, in my last job at the coalition, somehow part of civil rights and that work for almost 20 years, and in my role, I was just an intern when I first started, and that was something that was, I want to be an intern here at the coalition. When I was going into my junior year at Howard, and since then I've never directly worked for the coalition. I actually worked in civil rights. I've worked, at a union. I've worked in politics. And so I wanted to give it a try. And for 15 months, I did. It was a great experience. What I realized, though, is that you have to be passionate about the work. We were often, in the 15 months I was there, defeated by, the Democrats had the majority, their inability to pass a policing bill, their inability to actually protect voting rights, and so women's rights. And so you just found yourself fighting and feeling defeated. And when you're in the space, it makes you appreciate more of what those who came before you, the work they did, because it's continued to be a journey. I think it's like the David and Goliath, and how you continue to try to somehow overcome Goliath. And I realized that my passion was not there. And I wanted to go back to the private sector, and I did. I think the one thing I left with the coalition was being a part of really championing and doing events and supporting Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. And I felt like that was good to be a part of that as I left to the corporate space. And so. And so here I am. I've been at Ogilvy almost a year. That is crazy. I know. I've been there almost a year, and based in the DC office. And I tell you, it's so unique about the Ogilvy office itself in DC is that we've always been in spaces where men have always been leading, especially agencies like Ogilvy. But from top down, there was woman leadership there who they were just doing an excellent job. And I came in so impressed by the leaders that run the DC office, and then directly my boss, Lisa Miller, who definitely, I think, you want to, my couple of jobs before the reason for me leaving is just having bad managers. And I think what we've seen, even from 2020, we've seen that they said the Great Quit Recession was part of that. Is 50% of if you have a bad manager, and so having just really a great manager at Ogilvy has been just amazing. And I think my experience has been really great for the past, I guess, almost year. So,
and how often are you going into the office? That's the standard.
Oh, that probably also makes it better.
That's a standard question I'm asking everyone. I'm taking it's an unofficial question.
Yes. So once a week. And so in because of that, now we have a standard of 3 days, a 3 day a week policy. However, you know, we have different clients. The main client that I work on is for FEMA, but we do our focus on pre-disaster work. So a lot of people don't actually know. So the client is FEMA. So what people think of FEMA is like post-disaster come in, clean up and outreach. And we're focused on more of the CERT contract, which is everything's about mitigation. Everything's out, you know, pre-hazard, pre-disaster. So that's the work that I focus on. And because of that, the team is spread out throughout the country. Mm. So there's really, so if I came in 3 to 4 days a week, I'm just in a booth because I'm on calls all the time. Mm-hmm. So that definitely helps that, that the 1 day a week, it's great.
And, how are you? And so now it's a lot, you're enjoying having a good manager and a good team. And do you have to, because a client like this, there's a lot going on around the country. Do you have to do a lot of traveling or not much?
I don't. So I am in my home all the time, and I love it. You know, the one thing too, and the part of the work that I do is, and the work that I do and that we do as a team is help with the RNPN, which is the Resiliency National Partnership Network. And so that works consists of about 16 organizations across the country. Who are thought leaders, who are from the tribal community, who, you know, they are, you know, private sector, state and local government, who come together to talk about and to figure out ideas of how to become more resilient. And so, and just having an amazing team. So it's definitely night and day. Obviously, I've had almost 2 decades of building private and public partnerships. And so kind of being a part of a piece of this contract, being a part of the team, leading the team has been really great. But it also has been able to, you know, my previous roles, I've managed people and, you know, I've taken lesson learned, but then be able to really apply that in this way as well. So it's been really great to support my team. But then also being able to really implement, all the leadership books I've read and also through courses. So it's been great.
What are some of your favorite leadership books?
One actually is called Anxiety and Leadership and How You Manage It, How You Lead, the Ask the Why. It's really, really a great book. And then one is like, how do you motivate a team? And I think that's just really, those are really, and I forgot the title of that, has been really great for me and in my career so far. But yeah, other than that, it's funny because I think my family, my best friend slash brother called me one day and I put him on hold. He overheard me talking to my team and he says, shit, man, if they really knew who you were, they wouldn't be as impressed. I'm like, you got that right. It's like a funny thing how, you know, it's so funny how your brother, your friends know of you this way from college and you guys are, and then all of a sudden they get a glimpse of you, in a different light. And they're like, fuck man, you actually know what you're talking about. I'm like, a little bit. I always say that. Don't tell me why I'm smart. Just make them think I'm crazy. But yeah.
Well, the problem is your best friend slash brother, you know, knows you from when you were probably, you know, 10 and he has that fixed image in his mind and he's like, you know, it's hard. It's, you know, parents have the same difficulty shaking that same image.
Yeah. I think my mom has been like, okay. She's like, you know, impressed. I think this is one of these jobs where my parents, like when their friends, like, what does Josh do? They're able to really articulate these past two jobs. Like what does he do? And they're able to like, he does this, and not ashamed of my previous work. You know, parents who live in a liberal place like Berkeley, you know, you want to make sure that your kid is like fighting the fight and doing great work. And then you're like, what does your son do? I'm like, he does like, you know, third party coalition building for, you know, Boeing. And I'm like, what the fuck is that? Like, why? You know, so.
Yeah, you can't get any more progressive than Berkeley.
Yeah, I know. Well, yeah, for sure. It's an interesting place. It's probably why I moved back to D.C. in 2020.
Oh, why you moved back to D.C.?
Yeah. So, you know, I went to Howard and then I graduated. I mean, I went to Howard, and when I graduated, I had a brief stint in Tidewater in Virginia, in the Virginia Beach, Norfolk area. Mm-hmm. Once that campaign was done, I worked for Young Democrats of America for an extension of Tim Kaine. I moved back to D.C. And since then, been there. I was there for 16 and a half years. My job ended working for SEIU, and I had this like 2 years of coming home, like, oh my God, this is great. This is amazing. I'm going to go home. And not really thinking it through. You don't have the Rolodex there, the connection there. You left at 18, you're coming back at 34.
Yeah.
And so I took that journey, and what I realized is tech is so white. And so you're trying to break into a space in San Francisco that's predominantly tech. And I didn't want to get into the nonprofit. And there's two things. One, their focus, some was hyper-local. So I didn't have local experience. Mm-hmm. However, my national experience working in politics nationally definitely can translate. I had enough of a connection to elected officials, but wasn't enough. Or I would consult for a tech firm, even though 3 months prior I applied for this job, 3 months later now I'm consulting for them. They're asking me to do the work, or help someone else they hire instead of me. So you doubt the roadblocks of what you hear about, right? Being Black and trying to just get into tech and the challenges of that, right? And then the connectivity, how is this person connecting to you? We have in non-technical positions a color issue. Like, what would be that barrier initially? Is it connecting with the recruiter first to get past that first barrier? To, you know, I've had probably 5,000 coffees, you know, with either my parents' friends or with people I just met randomly. And the things were, hey, you're a little bit too confident. You know, why are you dressed up? You know, you have to be so technical about what you did, like what I did. And where in D.C., I've always described myself as a Swiss Army knife. I've done a little bit of everything. I've done lobbying. I've done policy. You know, I've done partnerships. I've raised money. Where you go back to California in a place like San Francisco, you have to, like, what is your thing? And I'm like, I'm really good at all these things. And here's like proofs of that. And so that was just, you know, realizing those challenges. I said, I'm going to move back home.
And now you're back in D.C.
And now I'm back in D.C.
It feels good.
It feels good. There's definitely within the 3.5 years I have been gone. It's definitely some, you can tell the changes.
Yeah.
But it's good to be back in a space where you're familiar. You know, I think that time of 3.5 years being at home, I feel like I was just surviving.
Uh-huh.
Right. I have a therapist now. And she's amazing. And I was like, what do you want to work on? Right? Or this list. And I said, you know, I feel like I'm just surviving my whole life. I feel like just, you know, if you grew up, you know, you're growing up in the way I did in foster care, your mom was a drug addict and you moved over and your grandmother became your foster care parent and not feeling loved and having to just figure things out at an early age, I was just in survival mode. So my whole life, it's like in surviving. Oh, I get this paycheck, get this. Let me get this job because I don't have a job. So then all of a sudden now you're not being intentional, right? About how or strategic about the jobs you're taking. Oh, I can't ask for help because for so long I didn't ask for help, right? How does surviving show up within your friendships? How does surviving show up within your relationships? And survival mode, because you're not thinking about long term, you think about right now. You're surviving, that means you lack of vulnerability, right? So then, like, what does lack of vulnerability look like from having childhood trauma from a mother who you love, who you feel like the only person who loved you, a biological mother, to where her drug addiction prevented her from showing up consistently? So now you have attachment issues. You're not connected. You have lack of vulnerability because I can't get connected to you because this may happen. And so there was just the things of where, like, okay, that, like, these are the things that are happening. These are you recognizing. Now, how are you putting some things into place? But also understanding therapy and your work is never overnight. So this has been like a journey in the past, even recently, to finding one, a really great therapist, to really be a partner in my journey. We're reading a book called How We Heal. And it was so funny because when I first met with her for the first 15 minutes, she said, "Hey, I want to, real quick question. I had asked, hey, I just bought this book. Are you okay with me reading it? Or is this a great book?" She said, "Wait a minute." And she pulled the same book out. And so we are reading the same book. And then my homework is journaling. And but so a lot of this can show up from your personal life to your professional life. And so I've been recently in this journey, because I think in life, we're always on a journey of healing if you're not stopped, but also understanding you're not beating yourself up, that it's not happening as quickly as you would like, because slow progress is always lasting progress.
And so, Josh, I always find you, it's always so great to talk to you. You are so incredibly honest isn't the right word, but just you know, open and straightforward. There's no, it's really, it's quite refreshing. What was the book that you and your therapist were reading?
How We Heal.
How You Heal. Okay. And so how do...
How We Heal, yeah.
And how, and so because of your childhood and the trauma and the and your mom, how did you find that that was manifesting itself in your work and your friendships today?
You know, here's the thing. There's a difference between a leader and a manager. You have a person who can manage, right? You can manage a project, maybe manage your team kind of. But leaders inspire, right? Leaders want to see that you flourish. Leaders support you in owning some part of the work that you're doing. Leaders gives you that productive feedback with an actual tool. But also leader, that person, it is imperative for them to be vulnerable, to share your experiences. To mistakes are just lesson learned. So as a leader, I have to then be vulnerable. And that has played out sharing my story, sharing somebody feel like they fucked up. I'm like, well, shit, me too. And here's how I fucked up. And this is how we're going to do it. Because as a leader, you don't fuck up. We fuck up and we can figure this out. Mm-hmm. And it's mistakes. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you're talking about vulnerability and survival. From a personal, everything's been like, I got to figure this out. I got credit card debt because I 3.5 years and not having a job, up and down. I got to survive just to make the payments, right? I'm just surviving to be with you, nothing else. Not thinking long term, coming in thinking, okay, well, can I really truly be vulnerable? There's layers of vulnerability, right? There's that survival of like, oh, well, this is for the moment. But why can't I think long term with you? What is preventing me from that? How is that showing up after 4 or 5 months? And so never have I, and so recently being in a, and I've had a therapist before, been in a situation where, like, I've never written out, like, what do I want? And, you know, for so long, you can talk a great game, right? You know, I can say the right things, but what am I doing to put those things in action? How am I surrounding, how am I being intentional around having the people in my life? In the first chapter of How We Heal, how are you having people in your life that supports your journey of healing? Mm-hmm. Right? And so I've been more open, and this is, to me, I'll be honest with you, Jim, this is like a layer of vulnerability, right? Because I still have to work on going deeper, peeling back the onions. But I share stories because I don't want hopefully a person one day will listen to this podcast and then it's like, man, I need this therapist. Man, this person's story just really inspired me to do this, right? Because I always believe, you know, it's like a thing of, I'm so fortunate where I have my parents who, for those who did not listen to the first part one of our podcast.
Yeah, yeah. Give people a little bit of your background.
Yeah, I know. I'm thinking like people are listening to this part one.
They may not have. And I would encourage people to go back and listen to the first episode because it is.
You put this pressure on me, Jim, that like where I need to have as good of.
There is no pressure.
Make it entertaining.
Well, that's what I mean. But, you're so. You're just kind of matter of fact, open, and just, this is my life. And you tell, well, anyway, so tell people your story.
Yeah. So when I was 11 years old, I used to go to this after school program for lower income kids in Berkeley. I grew up in West Oakland, moved to Berkeley. And there was a woman there who took a year off from being a journalist, a sports journalist. And so she tutored me and three of my other friends. And, you know, we just connected. It was just like an instant connection. And I always think it could have been someone else, but it was me. And so after she stopped tutoring, she remained my tutor. As a matter of fact, I was really good at basketball at the time. My mom was just like growing up as a tomboy. And my mother just fell into like being my tutor. And I would never imagine this white woman from Beechwood, Ohio, right outside of Cleveland, to be so instrumental in my life. Has always been a piece of a puzzle. So every time I start a puzzle and complete it, she's a part of that. And then later on, building a relationship with her then boyfriend, then husband, who has been, often say, my father has taught me, who is a white guy from New England. I said, you know, people, oh, how's your dad? I said, my dad is really Jesus. My dad went to University of Massachusetts Amherst. Two master's degrees, one in theological studies from Berkeley, and decided to be a carpenter. He is just the most amazing man. He's
really
built this house.
Yeah,
my dad has taught me how to cook. I mean, my dad has like, he's just, you know, he is amazing. He's probably the reason why I love Mozart and Beethoven and symphony, like all those things. My father is just, he is a true Renaissance man. And for a person who lacked a mother and a father, and how they just really filled that void for me. But more importantly, my father in this way, where he taught me what it is to be a man about 50 to 60%. But a white man can never teach a black boy how to be a man. My father has really set the foundation and principles that I often still look to. My dad is quiet until I make him martinis. And so he has been a father who often, he leads by example. And I am so fortunate where when I yearn for love that I found love with my parents. I'm their only child. And so I'm very fortunate. You know, you grow up as a kid who grew up with an older sister and a younger sister. I have three other sisters on my father's side. You grew up as a middle child. And I felt lost. You know, I'm not saying that my grandmother did not love me, but it didn't show. It showed with my other two siblings. And so you go from a middle child to eventually start calling my mother when I was in ninth grade. And then 10th grade, start calling my dad, dad. Because again, my dad's just like a quiet guy, you know, it's like all the time is my mother. And then eventually, you know, I remember like it was yesterday still. My social worker came when I was 18, actually at 17, after my junior prom, I tell my grandmother I no longer wanted to stay with her. In ninth grade, I was just a kid with a 1.67 GPA and a reading and math level of seventh grade. My life changed and my mother really started, my tutor started really getting involved in my life in school and got me out of remedial courses, helped me, her and my other family on the track, her friends and family on the track to actually graduate from high school, go to college. My grades changed from a 1.67 when I was in ninth grade to a 3.7 when I was in 12th grade. By 12th grade, by my time for me to actually begin applying to colleges, I was at that point about 3.5. But I remember that I had asked, and at the same time, my grandmother often told me that my housework became before my schoolwork, not having that support at home, even though I had an older sister who had got, you know, pregnant, married, and went to college all by 17. And so I just had the focus and determination to make it happen, but only because my parents saw something in me, believed in me before I saw it in myself. And so when I decided that I needed, wanted to move out, I moved with my aunt at the time, and she had just gotten her, she was on paternity leave, she worked at UPS. So it was perfect timing where she worked evening shift, so I'll be home by the evening time, and I can watch her newborn, her two other kids. So that happened for about 8 months until I turned 18. My social worker had asked my grandmother, hey, where's Josh? Oh, he decided to live with his aunt. Oh, well, that's illegal. You know, yeah, my grandmother could have lied because, you know, she lied about my sister staying there and she didn't, you know, still collect the check. But my social worker then came to my job, my school, when I turned 18. That was 2 months into my senior high school. And she told me, hey, I just pulled up your transcript. You can graduate a semester early from high school. Great. But I can, but I need another semester to go to college. Well, you're 18, so we're going to kick you off of foster care. And I was devastated. You know, I've come so far. Mm-hmm. Right. Super active in high school and president of Black Student, all these things, and imagining, okay, I graduate a semester early, then what for me? And so I went back to my aunt and said, hey, listen, they're going to kick me off of foster care. And this is the situation. And her response was, you have to leave. You have no money. You have to leave. Hmm. And so then I went to my grandma and said, hey, they're going to kick me out. Can I move back in? And she goes, no. Well, yeah, you can if you work and pay all the rent. Now, there's many people who live in my grandma who never paid their rent. So now I'm in this conundrum of what to do. So I called my parents and said, listen, I have no place to live. I don't know what to do. And my mom talked to my dad. My dad he took the wash and dry out of the back room, put it in the hallway, and a futon to move in my parents. You know, I often think about those times when we have this, I think we think about foster care kids and we see the system that's, you know, I take it back when I got held back in first grade. There was a prison bed made up for me in the state penitentiary. Because, you know, statistically, a kid who gets held back in first grade, the chances of that person actually succeeding slim. Then I think about, I'm on a track in sixth and seventh grade reading a math level, and they put me in remedial courses already in high school. That's another bed made up for me. As a kid who then grew up in a foster care system, that's another bed made up for you. Because we know the percentage of the route of that kid going from being homeless to being in prison to death increases tremendously in the system. Mm-hmm. So when I think about that, you know, I'm like, how fortunate I am. But then I also think about my moments of when I told my parents, and then the moment I packed my bags. And this is the part where I'm talking about the foster care and the kids who have been left out. When you don't have nothing, we don't own nothing. I didn't own a suitcase. And so I laugh every time I take my garbage out, because that was the only thing I owned.
That's how you carried your belongings in a bag.
To my parents' house.
Yeah. At this point, they're not your parents yet, right?
They're not my parents. Now, right. I've called my mother when I was in ninth grade.
But just so people understand, when they agreed to take you in, they were not your parents yet. And so they
not my parents. Didn't have money to pay for college. I paid for school myself. You know, nothing.
And so why was your grandmother? So you had a sister that got pregnant and went on to college.
My sister got pregnant, got married. That was her escape. Uh-huh. Like that was her escape route to like leaving the house.
Yep. Yep.
Escape route. I'm gone. Right. I'm 15 years old. 16. Got pregnant. I'm done. And my grandmother approved for her to get married. Grew up in like Christian household. You got to be married before you're pregnant, blah, blah, blah. Like, boom.
Wow.
And so that was her.
Yeah. And then when you came back, why was your grandmother so tough on you, saying you got to work, you got to pay the rent?
You know, I don't know, because I paid, you know, I stopped playing basketball in ninth grade. I was ineligible. And then I hurt my foot. And then I'm like, I have to start working. Mm-hmm. So I was doing 20 hours, you know, almost 20 hours a week in high school, just working, because I had to start buying my own clothes and figuring things out, even though my grandmother provided food. But, mm-hmm. you know, it is, I tell the story for somehow a young person would hear this about how you feel lost and not loved. Mm-hmm. And how at days you feel like you want to give up. Mm-hmm. About how you feel like you have to do this by yourself in survival mode, that you have to get out of that mode and let people open up, let people come to you, ask for help. And I still struggle with that. Mm-hmm. Because you can't overcome trauma that's happened for you, and especially in those really important years of your life, to think now I'm okay at 41.
And so every day you have to work on stepping out of survivor mode.
Exactly.
It's a continuing, right. It's not just one and done and now I can move on. It's every day trying to open up and not be on the defensive, not scanning for problems.
Not being in the most overused words and being in really intentional about how are you being vulnerable, about prioritizing yourself about how are you showing up for people? How are you allowing people? You know, someone can always pour into my cup, but how am I allowing them, right? Like, how am I pouring into their cup? Mm-hmm. How am I being open to talk about my challenges?
Well, your parents, and I've heard you talk about, they've been a tremendous influence on you. And I can still tell, when we're talking before we started recording, how close you are to them.
I mean, yeah. Yeah, my mother would love for me to call her every day. But, you know, my dad is like the real, like, low-key dude. He's like, oh, yeah, we talked. And then my mom's like, what the fuck, man? You talked to me for 45 minutes. Like, Mom, I talk to you 3 times a week. Dad's like once a month, you know? But, you know, I mean, I am so fortunate. And, you know, we talk about workspaces. You know, I think we talked about this before, press and record, around imposter syndrome as a Black person, or even in how are you showing up as in general, where we talk about your comfortability in a workspace that doesn't look like you. And, you know, I have to check my privilege at the door, because I also know that I don't have those challenges in a white space, predominantly white space, in a white working space. I don't have this place where I'm trying to just like, you don't feel connected because there's no one who doesn't look like you. Because actually Ogilvy is great, but the majority of the people who work there are women. And so then they're black women. Right. Which is like, okay. Like, you know, because I didn't at 11 years old, there was no choice for me. I had to like get comfortable.
So you dealt with imposter syndrome when you were 11. So
when I was 11.
So now it's yeah.
Oh, right. You, like, you, there's no choice.
Interesting. Okay.
Figuring out, right. Yeah. Yes. Later in my life, I started to think, damn, like, am I still connected what was considered Black? But then I had to check myself and say, well, yes, because I love opera, or because I can speak eloquently about art, or because I love the ballet, does not make me less Black. We have, society has decided that Blackness, and when Black people have accepted this idea that your Blackness is determined by you growing up poor, you live in certain neighborhoods, by the lack of wealth that you have, that you cannot be, you quote unquote, Black or down if you grew up in a certain neighborhood. We are non-monolithic. So we actually, our Blackness cannot be determined by that. But in the moment of 26, the kid who grew up poor, you know, who was not exposed, you start looking at yourself 10 years later, like, well, shit, man, how do I live all this shit? The shit that I told my parents of oyster eating and making cioppino and paella, I'm like, what the fuck is this shit I can't even pronounce? Now I'm shucking my own oysters, right? I'm making my own duck. You know, I'm buying my own ballet tickets and wearing it, you know? And so you start thinking it's so different from, you know, my best friend's been missing since 2005. My cousin was killed. My other friend was killed, right? My friends are in jail. These are experiences that you have, and that people, you go back home like, fuck, man, how privileged I am. Like, shit, am I this? And realizing, no, like, I'm still Black. They still love me. It's just I've been fortunate enough to have people in my life to expose me. And because I've been exposed, right, to these things, my friends call me bougie. I say exposed. Mm-hmm. I realized that my upbringing that I never forget. And to be honest with you, I still look at myself as a poor Black kid. I'm a poor Black kid. And then the other extreme, my relatability is upper middle class white. Because I've never had an experience with upper middle class Black people until I moved into after college. And still to this day, can't really relate. And so I keep that grounded within my friends who still love me, who did not have the opportunity, did not have a Jackie in her life, a Larry in their lives. Like, I see how fortunate I am and how I try to bring that vulnerability, how I try to make sure that whatever is considered culture, that I'm able to share those with people who look like me, who have those struggles, right? You may not have the opportunity, but maybe some words of inspiration or some tools I can give them within their toolbox, which is really important.
Well, it's incredible how, and Jackie and Larry are your parents, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you call them your parents, not your step parents, right?
No, I always jokingly say, and I always say my mother's Jewish. And I was like, oh, I'm Jewish. But I always, people say, oh, your parents, something. I was like, yeah. I was like, unfortunately, they're white. And they people just start looking at me. Like, wait, this is crazy. I was like, it's always good. I have some of the most inappropriate jokes that we say over the dinner table. When you have white parents, your mother's Jewish. It's really great. I tell you, it's amazing. But all my cousins from bar mitzvahs all have Howard t-shirts. So that's important.
I don't know where I was going with this. I'm speechless.
And, you know, for me, I know, and I feel like you've asked the question and I'm like rambling. I'm like,
No, that's right.
Is and what's going to be. And, but imposter syndrome was that, you know, I tell you, I dated a woman who was a speech coach. And her name was Hillary. She's amazing. And she's an executive coach and she does, you know, find your voice. And I should say this, though, where up until I met her, I hid my voice. I hid my voice because I used to have a higher pitched voice for a couple of reasons, I think, because how I learned how to speak was because of educated white people. So I spoke with a higher pitched voice to sound that way, to feel that way, right? And then realizing for her as his voice coach and executive coach would say, what are you doing? Like, you can't, you know, and at the time I was helping a young man, his leadership role at a tech company, and saying, how do you show up as being your true self? But why am I not showing up being my true self? Why am I not having accepted my voice? And so from that point on, I've just really kind of accepted my voice.
How old were you when you worked with this executive coach, speech coach?
Well, she wasn't. She was my the woman I was dating. And I was like, yeah.
And how old were you when this took place?
I don't know, 33, 34.
Okay. And prior to that, you were mimicking a voice that just wasn't your own, really. It was
Right. You know, I think when you.
Yeah.
It's like anything, you know, any mannerism you may pick up from someone who, you know, a close friend or your parents. We pick up habits. I pick up habits from my parents. Mm-hmm. And so at age 11, or once I got older, to be able to really put sentences together, I mimic the voices that where I've learned how to speak properly. Mm-hmm. And so being able to own that. And so I think when you talk about imposter syndrome and being that's why I always share the stories of that. You know, even when we talk about just being so raw and truthful, I still to this day, you know, I start with I. I rarely say we. Years ago, I used to say we to try to hide my accountability. So if I can say we all, that's not directly saying me, like I need to improve, like I need to be a better boyfriend, a better partner. We all have done these things. No, I've done these things. That's the first step. It's like I, you know, you know, I realize we can't walk around like a shit don't stink, like in how are we fixing it? So I start with me. I start with me first. I think that's really just the first step of figuring it out. You know, I'm just on this continued journey of healing and figuring things out. And that's what's important. And so if you're able to share that, then that's even better.
Well, Josh, I think you're going to be sharing that on a larger and larger stage as you continue on your journey. We're already at 40 minutes, and I try to keep the show to 30 minutes.
I feel like we just have a history. I think last time.
A couple of things. One, all right, we have to do an episode with your mom, as we've talked about.
Yes.
And I'm happy to be part of it. Or you can guest host the show and have your mom on. And the fact that
I think it'll be good for
what's that?
It would be good to just you could be a part of it. That probably be more of an entertaining hour of you talking about showing up. As you know, Jim, I've listened to a lot of your interviews and I'm like, why do you want to keep interviewing me? Everyone else is so esteemed and work for the Clinton administration, Obama. You have this kid who's done a little bit of everything and who curses all the time. So I want to keep your show so classy. My mother's probably shaking her head saying right now when she listens to this, this is my son who curses and so real.
Well, we're gonna get her opinion on your cursing. We're gonna
My father curses a lot. That's why I curse. So there you go.
She can blame him. I have a feeling your mom's gonna be running the show to be the actual host by the time we get done with the show, but the episode. All right, so we're gonna do that. We're gonna schedule a time, if your mom is willing, to have her on, and do that show. And
yeah, we should like make her, because I think, you know, and I will end with this though, Jim. It's my mother and I, though we grew up 2,000 miles away, sure, with a two-parent household, grew up in a upper middle class neighborhood outside of Cleveland. Once I got older, to talk about some of our experiences and how we connect was just amazed me, right? It really tells you how you can come from different backgrounds, but what's your connectivity to that? And my mother and I have really found from our personal experiences with family how we connect and how we evolve. And so being able to give my mother advice and vice versa, where she's giving me advice when I was younger, mm-hmm. Now giving her advice and sharing our stories has just been a really 360 experience for me.
Well, let's we can talk about that, and we can also talk about is there more that we can do as a society to reach out to young kids who are in situations like yours, and we can explore that whole topic.
Yeah, no, that'd be great, you know, and also really talk about, you know, my mother in this way of like how does my mother privilege shows up when, you know, you have a son, but you don't think about what are those things that Black women think about, right? When your son's driving, when your son's in life.
Yeah. Yeah. And you said that that Larry, your dad, could get you 60% of the way there. How do you get the rest of the way there?
I was so fortunate outside of looking up to drug dealers and who are my friends. You know, I had two. One is this, my godmother, who's amazing, a Black woman, who was just amazing. I love her. She's really balanced Jackie out. They balance each other out. Her best friend, call him Uncle Bill, has been like a godfather to me. My first year, I met him at Howard. He has been everything to me. You know, I've met two, him and then this, an older guy named Arbery Dent, who went to medical school, passed away in 2014. Think about him every day. Hmm. And a teacher named Mr. McKnight has really been, those three has really been that really foundation for me. And Barbie was of my North Star of what it is to be a Black man, right? How are you showing up in spaces, the challenges? I talked to my Uncle Bill about that just over the holidays. You have to seek that out.
It doesn't just happen.
You know, you have to really seek that out. And that was I don't know what made me seek it out. I think it's still this urge of wanting to feel love, this urge of wanting to feel grow, the urge of having the right people in your life.
All right. Well, we will, and we will explore that some more with your mom.
Yeah.
Well, Josh, it's always great to have you on. And
thank you. Sorry, we didn't talk about so much of Ogilvy, but
that's all right. That's all right. And for our listeners out there, remember you can follow us on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, and you can sign up for our email. It's politicallife.net. And Josh, this has been great, and we will be speaking again very soon.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. See you now.
Thanks. See you later.